Hello, everyone. This is Danny Fisher, and this is the Buddhist Studies Podcast. Okay, welcome. This podcast, I think, as many of you know, is a long time coming. I announced, I think, back in January or February that I had wanted to get this started. Unfortunately, life happens, and I didn't get to it as quickly as possible. And though I'd had some experience with these things before, I think I underestimated how much work is involved in putting these together. So I apologize for the delay, and I hope as we proceed, I'm able to stay on the track that I'd like to, which is a podcast every week or at least every 2 weeks. I think since this has been, again, such a long time coming, I'll avoid kind of reintroducing what we're doing here and refer you instead to the video that I put out in January, February, where I sort of framed this podcast and what we'll be doing. For practical purposes, though, I guess I'll just remind everyone that we're looking at the book Buddhist Religions, A Historical Introduction, the fifth edition by Richard H. Robinson, Willard L. Johnson, and Tanisara Bhikkhu. What I'd like to do is move section by section through the book. I'm not going to say up front that we'll do something like a chapter a week. It may turn out to be more like one of the kind of subsections of a chapter a week. And as I said in the video, I think it depends on how much material is there. There are some sections where we could probably go into great depth and even do a couple of podcasts for each section. There are other cases where I think between the limits of my knowledge and maybe just the limits of knowledge in the field generally, there may not be very much to say about certain parts, and we'll be able to sort of move a little bit more quickly through those. So we'll just see what happens. Today, my intention is for us to look at the preface, yes, the preface, and the introduction of the book. So if you have a copy, those are pages Roman numeral 14 to 15 and Roman numeral 19 to 23. So we're not moving through a lot of material today, but it'll give us plenty to talk about. As I just alluded to, I suppose by way of an introduction to what I'll be doing with this material. Yes, I am a professor in a religious studies department. Basically, I teach sort of practical theology, counseling skills, and yeah, again, Buddhism sort of theologically. So I'm not a Buddhologist per se, although I've had training in certain areas, including language, which I think will be useful here, but I'm certainly not an expert on every tradition of Buddhism, Buddhism broadly speaking. So some of this will be as educative for me as for you. I've read this book before, but I think I'll be challenged in certain ways when it comes to presenting, particularly Buddhism of East Asia, which I'm not particularly well-versed in a scholarly way, whereas I've had I've done a fair amount of work when it comes to studying both early Buddhism and sort of what they call the quote-unquote Indo-Tibetan Buddhist tradition, although that's a problematic term. We'll look at a lot of problematic terms as we go through this, but that would be sort of the area where I suppose I might have more strength, and also certainly Buddhism in the Western world and sort of modern expressions of Buddhism I've had some experience with. That said, I mean, I have kind of the training and the skills to do a fair job with this. We'll see what happens. And I look forward to your feedback and things that hearing from listeners about what they would like me to do more of or feel that I could do a better job of and that sort of thing. I think, as I mentioned in the video, what I'd like to do with each of the posts that contain these podcasts is to also include a reading list. Buddhist religions will be the primary source, but when it comes to, again, my knowledge and specifically the limits of my knowledge, there will be times when I'm going to want to look at other materials to help me talk about it in a way where I feel like I have more information. So there are a couple of books that have already kind of emerged as I think useful to me as I'm moving through this material. So I just wanted to sort of talk about those, and I will have all the bibliographical information for these in the post that this podcast is embedded with. So look on my blog, dannyfisher.org, for that, and that's dannyfisher.org. The other books are specifically John Strong's The Experience of Buddhism, Sources and Interpretations, 3rd edition. And this is also published by the Thompson Wadsworth Press, which is an educational press that is the publisher of Buddhist religions. So you could look at it as in many ways a companion to this book. I'm looking at a book my friend Charles Prebisch edited called Buddhism, A Modern Perspective. It's a collection of writing about sort of Buddhism across the board by students of Richard H. Robinson, who is the original author of Buddhist Religions. I'm looking at the two-volume Buddhist Spirituality, 1 and 2, edited by Takeuchi Yoshinori, and again, it's an anthology of writing by quite a few scholars, specialists in various areas. And lastly, a more recent book, Donald W. Mitchell's Buddhism, Introducing the Buddhist Experience, which I think is a pretty terrifically put together book in a lot of ways. And again, I think as we move through this material, there's a way that the authors of Buddhist religions have organized. And Mitchell does some things similarly, but some things differently, as do the other books I'm looking at. And I think it's going to be helpful to have that other perspective as well. In addition, I'm using two resources that I find particularly helpful. One is the Oxford Dictionary of Buddhism by Damien Keown, who's a Buddhist studies scholar in Great Britain, and also Robert Buswell's, who's the editor, Encyclopedia of Buddhism, which is a kind of massive two-volume resource which you can probably find in a lot of academic libraries. So again, these are books I'm going to be using to help me fill out gaps in my knowledge or places where I have questions as I'm going through this, because again, even though I've read this book a couple of times now, I've not taught it before. So there'll be issues, for me, in preparing that. So I think that's, long enough mea culpa, there, and we can get started. Why are we starting with the preface? I think a lot of people might rightly wonder that. I think often when I don't know about often, but sometimes when I assign readings to my students, I'll include the pages in, say, the preface or introduction. Not always, but if it's useful information, I will. But I find often people kind of skip right over that. And I don't think it's necessarily because of laziness or anything like that. It's more, I think you presume it's just a lot of thank yous and doesn't really have any information that we need to look at. In this case, I think it has a lot of information that we need to take into consideration, especially if we're going to, if we might be inclined rather to quote unquote judge a book by its cover. So obviously, if you're familiar with Buddhism a little bit, I think you might recognize, more specifically Buddhist studies, you might recognize that the authors of Buddhist religions are effectively two Buddhist scholars and a Buddhist monk. Buddhist monk of the Dhammayut order, which is a Thai forest tradition order. And so you might presume by looking at the authors, well, they might do certain things well, but not other things well. And I think the preface gives us some clues about homework they've done and things they've tried to do as good a job as possible in presenting this material. So I want to talk about the three authors very quickly, and then I want to look at the preface and some of the people they've thanked and the things that these folks have done for the book that are important as we move forward and realize what we're getting into. I think it's impossible to talk about the history of Buddhist studies as an academic discipline in the United States without talking a lot about Richard H. Robinson. We could look at him as sort of the godfather, in some ways, of Buddhist studies as a discipline, at least in North America. He's sort of effectively the founder of the Buddhist studies program at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, which was the first academic program specifically tailored to Buddhist studies in the United States. Among others, it produced some scholars who became incredibly important in their own right, including Lewis Lancaster, Charles Prebisch, my friend who edited the book I mentioned, Roger Corliss, Stephen V. Baer, lots of folks. I could go on with some of these names. You know, so many of them, I think, feel a great debt and gratitude to him as a mentor. And they have, in turn, been really important in mentoring not only their students directly, but those of us who do a lot of reading and pay attention to their work. Tragically, Robinson died young in 1970 as a result of an accident. I believe he was at a cabin, and it involved a gas stove or furnace of some kind. So there was an explosion, and he was killed in that. So, you know, taken in his prime, and we didn't really get a chance to see the whole, you know, an entire career filling out an entire life. But what we do get is an incredible amount of work just in the, you know, unfortunately brief time he was with us. Among other things, he did a very early translation of the Vimalakirti Sutra, which is a text we'll hear more about later, probably much later. And this work, which was taken by one of his students, Willard Johnson, and sort of seen into publication. I believe initially Robinson is the only credited author, and it was published under the title The Buddhist Religion, singular. Subsequent editions, I believe, added Johnson as a co-author. And now in this new edition, we have both a title change and the addition of a third author. So it goes from being called the Buddhist Religion X edition to Buddhist Religions, plural, a historical introduction, fifth edition. Let me say something about Johnson and Tanisara Bhikkhu, and then we'll say a little bit more about this title change. Johnson is on the religious studies faculty at the San Diego State University, was mentored by Robinson. He died in 2006 after having retired from SDSU. He has basically supervised all editions of this book. If I remember correctly, The Buddhist Religion, the first edition, was published the same year Robinson died. So Johnson has been involved even before his name was affixed to the front of the book. His sort of area of expertise was Indian languages and literature. Among other things, his PhD was on the Rig Veda, which is an important text in the Hindu religious tradition. Meditation was also a particular focus of his, and he wrote a book that's a history of meditation, and unfortunately I don't remember the title, but if you look up, if you Google Willard L. Johnson meditation history book, it should come up. And he was also he also did American Indian studies at SDSU. So this is a guy who had a lot of interest in it seems to me, contemplative traditions, shamanic traditions in a wide variety of areas. Thanissaro Bhikkhu is perhaps more familiar to most listeners as, you know, an incredibly prolific translator of the Pali Buddhist canon. If you go to the wonderful, wonderful website, Access to Insight, I think you have the option of kind of seeing an incredible variety of Pali texts that are translated by him. Access to Insight is a great website because they offer Pali texts translated by several different people. So you can look at, for example, the Metta Sutta and see a translation by Nyanaponikatera, Thanissaro Bhikkhu, Bhikkhu Bodhi, maybe, you know, folks like, so you get a, a variety of takes on how to translate these materials. And he's been a real leader that way. He's also known, by the way, as Ajahn Jeff, if you hear people mention that title. His real name is Jeffrey, and Ajahn is just a Thai word that means teacher, and the etymology of that word is from the Pali, Acharya, which means teacher. He is the abbot at Metta Forest Monastery in San Diego. In addition to his Pali translating, he's also a great sort of explicator of the Buddhist tradition. And I'm going to say he's written a lot. So basically I couldn't possibly cover everything he's written. I will single out one two volume text in particular, because I just find it astonishing. And it's one that's always on my shelf, which is called the Buddhist Monastic Code. And it's basically him explaining, the Vinaya, which is the monastic discipline. And it's really, really quite something. So I recommend that highly, even though you could read, for example, his five-volume meditations, which are collections of his Dharma talks, which are really quite profound and lovely and beautifully written. So basically anything with his name on it is well worth reading. So those are your authors. You have Richard H. Robinson, this titan of Buddhist studies. Willard Johnson, you know, a very accomplished student and obviously very loyal, wanting to help keep this work alive and preserve it right into the 21st century. And Thanissaro Bhikkhu, one of the great, great preservers of a Buddhist tradition, who's alive and teaching today. So as I said, this is the fifth edition, and one of the reasons, obviously, that you update a book is to incorporate new information, new scholarship, etc. In particular, the latter is important here. If you look at the various editions of these books, they've basically been kind of good signposts of where scholarship has radically changed in terms of Buddhist studies. Here, the authors say in the preface, in particular, the chapters on Indian Buddhism have been radically revised and reorganized, with two chapters, 4 and 5, entirely new. I think, you know, you could point to several Buddhist scholars in the last 15, 20 years who have really done a lot to change our perspective on the evolution of Buddhism in India, including folks like Gregory Chopin, and Jan Natier, who I'm going to talk a little bit more about here in a couple minutes, and others who have helped us to, I think, take a second look at some things we took for granted, integrate new information. They've really just helped us expand our knowledge of Indian Buddhism in a lot of ways. So I think what they say there about these chapters on Indian Buddhism and some of the work that they've added, I think it really is a reflection of a lot of this important work that's come out in the last 15, 20 years. They also point out that the revision process was really inspired by Jan Natier, who I just mentioned, and she's a professor at Indiana University, and Peter Gregory, at Smith College. And I want to say a little bit about these folks, since they had sort of an involvement in the creation of this new fifth edition, and what we can know about them in particular, and the set of eyes that they bring to this material. So Nadir, as I mentioned, has done some really extraordinary work. She's a very prolific author who writes on a kind of range of materials. Some readers may be familiar with her work, listeners in this case, may be familiar with her work about Buddhism in America. She has a great interest in early Indian Buddhism, but also modern-day Buddhism in North America. But in particular, I think she really has kind of taken the field by force with two books. One is called Once Upon a Future Time, Studies in the Buddhist Prophecy of Decline, which looks at how Buddhists have understood the continuum of history, sort of the beginning and end of history, and what that looks like, which is a really interesting subject in and of itself, and I think given a very special treatment by her. And then in particular, her book, A Few Good Men, The Bodhisattva Path According to the Inquiry of Ugra. What is particularly exciting about A Few Good Men, which has a great title, first of all, is that it has changed the way we think about the origins of the Mahayana. I think, a lot of Buddhist studies scholars these days will tell you that Mahayana Buddhism, its origins are not entirely clear. We have, explanations in texts, but we have to look at those with a critical eye because they're often being written by practitioners who have the promotion of traditions or ideas in mind, so they, they're not necessarily objective journalistic records or anything like that. Nadir suggests that in A Few Good Men, that if we look at some materials, it maybe challenges an idea we'll hear some more about later, that the Mahayana tradition of Buddhism emerged from as kind of a lay movement, an accessible path, an easy, quote-unquote, easy path for all to practice. And she suggests that it really probably started out as a very elite path could have started out as a more elite path for male monastics in particular, hence the title A Few Good Men. And that it was very, almost kind of esoteric and more for these sort of deep practitioner scholar types in the monastic tradition. So it's almost the complete opposite of, I think, what many people have historically thought of the origins of the Mahayana. But again, it's just one new piece of data to integrate into a very murky picture. It's been an important and compelling book for many people. So she was one person who the authors credit as bringing some material to the table that made them want to revisit, and some ideas to them that made them want to revisit the possibility of doing a new edition. The other is Peter Gregory of Smith College, and his area of expertise is medieval Chinese Buddhism, especially the Chan and Huayan traditions during the Tang and Song dynasties. For Buddhist studies scholars, Peter Gregory has been important as the executive director of the Kuroda Institute for the Study of Buddhism and Human Values, and also the director of some really important book publication series, including Studies in East Asian Buddhism and Classics of East Asian Buddhism through Kuroda. So he's been really important in terms of creating some apparatuses and organizations that have really helped benefit the study of Buddhism. And he brings an expertise in East Asian Buddhism to the table here. So that's significant to me to know that, because these are very different expertise than maybe Robinson Johnson and Tanisaro Bhikkhu bring to the table. They also acknowledge John McCrae of Indiana University, who he's also a very important translator of East Asian texts and looking at many things kind of in the East Asian Buddhism spectrum. Among other things, he's a translator of the Vimalakirti Sutra as well from the Chinese. And it's just a sort of an all-around important productive scholar that way. Richard Seeger of Hamilton College is also thanked. I think many readers and listeners probably know him as a scholar of Buddhism in America. He's edited a couple of volumes and done some work on Buddhism in America specifically. Karma Elikshe Somo of San Diego University, who is a Buddhist nun in the Tibetan tradition, who has done a lot of academic work about Buddhism and death and dying, Buddhism and women. She's been sort of one of the driving forces behind the Sakyadita International Organization for Women in Buddhism. So she brings a perspective that would, I think, pay close attention to the experience of Buddhist women here. Gil Fronsdahl, who, if you're listening to this podcast, you might be familiar with Zencast, which publishes a number of Gil's Dharma talks. And Gil's the founder of the Sati Center for Buddhist Studies. He has a PhD from Stanford. He studied extensively in both the Theravada and Zen traditions. He's also translated the Dhammapada. One of the more recent translations of that was done by Gil. Gil's also been active in care work. The Sati Center's Buddhist chaplaincy program has had obviously much influence and work from Gil. And he's wonderful, wonderful guy in a lot of respects in terms of just being a human being and also bridging study and practice. And then lastly, Clark Strand of Tricycle. And Clark has had experience studying in the Zen tradition. He's also written some books on haiku. So he has a really, I think, insightful, nuanced view of kind of straight-up poetry and also maybe poetical language and prose. Clark, also in his capacity for Tricycle, I think it would be fair to say that he has done a lot of work looking at areas that have maybe been neglected in writing about Buddhism, particularly in the journalistic world. I think the last significant English language interview with Daisetsu Keita, who's the founder of Soka Gakkai International, was done by Clark. I think he's a really great, he contributes something really important to the world of Buddhist journalism, this kind of attention to things that I think tend to get neglected. So it's terrific, I think, that he's included here. And then they also mention their reviewers at Wadsworth, who I think, again, are also worth talking about here. One is Jonathan Herman at Georgia State University. Herman's an expert on Chinese religions, and he's also the associate editor of the Encyclopedia of Religion and War, which is, a remarkable and interesting resource. Harry Krebs at Dickinson College, who was the co-designer / founder of the East Asian Studies major there. James P. McDermott, who is the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and a professor at Canisius College, which I think is in New York. And his area is early Buddhism, and he's done a lot of writing on Kama and some of these issues we'll hear more about later. And then lastly, James Santucci, who was formerly a professor at University of the West, where I teach. He's at Fullerton State College now. And I think it would be fair to say that Dr. Santucci is generally regarded as one of the great Sanskrit scholars around. So to know he's looking over the shoulder here, I think says a lot about how this book engages language. He's, I would think, would be a wonderful person to have look at a text where you're going to be relying heavily on Sanskrit terminology. So that may seem like minutia, but I find it important and worth knowing that they've had some really diverse, really expert eyes on this text that is trying to be somewhat comprehensive, but of course no one can be an expert in everything. So to know that they have gathered a wide variety of experts to kind of check their work and perhaps even add something to it, I think is really, really significant, and it's worth looking at the preface so you know who's been of aid in producing this book. Okay, so I'm going to move on from the preface now and into the introduction. And for the introduction, I think the authors have largely chosen to explain the title change. I think that would be fair to say that's what they're doing here. So early on, they make the point that Buddhism is a relatively recent term, and that it comes out of sort of 18th century thinkers of the European Enlightenment encountering the Buddhist world and trying to classify and categorize it. As the authors put it, they feel that Buddhists themselves have tended to use, you know, terms like Dharma or the Buddha's message or the Buddha's way to describe what it is that they're practicing, doing, studying, experiencing, etc. So that there hasn't been a term like Buddhism in the Buddhist world from their vantage point, and that term itself, Buddhism, is really an invention of 18th century European thinkers. They do point out that, you know, if someone wanted to split hairs, they might say Dharma Vinaya might be this term Dharma Vinaya might be a kind of analog for Buddhism. But they have a couple of things to say about that I think are worth quoting in full here. So one thing they say is, whereas Dharma Vinaya is meant to be prescriptive, advocating a way of life and practice, Buddhism is descriptive in that it simply denotes the actions of people who follow a vision of Dharma Vinaya without passing judgment on the validity of that vision or suggesting that the reader accept that vision or follow it. So there's more of an academic agenda wrapped up in the word Buddhism, that it's meant to be descriptive, informational, conveying information rather than conveying ideas in sort of a prescriptive, proselytizing sort of way. And then they basically make the same point I just did, which is to say its purpose is to portray the thoughts and actions of the large segment of the human race who have called themselves followers of the Buddha. So again, capturing actions and information rather than philosophy, religious doctrine, that sort of thing. And as the authors put it, I think very appropriately, the serious study of Buddhism in the West began in 1844 when the French philologist Eugène Burnouf came to the conclusion that certain religions encountered by European explorers and traders in East Asia, Tibet, India, Sri Lanka, and Southeast Asia were in fact branches of a single tradition whose home was in India. Burnouf is an interesting figure. I mean, I think his real area of expertise was Persian cuneiform. So he was, you know, sort of used to looking at inscriptions and things like this. And so his sort of coining of this term Buddhism and beginning the study of it kind of did two things. You know, on the one hand, it clarified things for, I think, the Western world, which didn't know what to make of these phenomena and these people that they were encountering. But it also confuses a little bit, too, because in this effort to sort of classify and categorize, you know, he sort of sets up these rigid boundaries where there weren't necessarily, and I think we're still kind of cleaning up some of the, I think the mess of that, frankly. You know, it's forgivable because it's a bold step forward in terms of studying something there was really not much study of before by the West. But of course, over time, scholars have developed greater nuance and insight into what was being examined. So yeah, that's, again, he both clarifies and confuses, I think. It's worth noting that, I think it was last year or maybe even earlier this year, Donald Lopez, who's at the University of Michigan and sort of a great modern scholar of Buddhism, did a translation of Bernouffe's Introduction to the History of Indian Buddhism with Katia Bufetrol. I don't know how to say her name. I apologize. And this book was written in 1844, so I think that's what the authors are referencing when they say it began then. You know, among other things, Bernouffe's book was owned by Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Friedrich Nietzsche, other philosophers too, including like Schopenhauer had a copy. So a lot of really important Western thinkers had read Bernouffe's book, had it around, thought about it. So that kind of says something about why his ideas took off. Really important thinkers in other disciplines and areas of work, you know, were aware of his work. It's worth pointing out, too, that Bernouffe did an early translation of the Lotus Sutra in 1852, which is a text we'll hear a lot more about later. So, you know, he left some pretty important early work. Again, that was both helpful and problematic. In fact, you know, we have the, you know, the author saying this, which I'll read straight. For more than a century after Bernouffe's discovery, Buddhologists, who are scholars of the Buddhist tradition, tried to delineate the essential characteristics of that common core, but the data refused to fit into any clearly discernible mold. As the Thais would say, it was like trying to gather live crabs into an open basket. The old crabs kept crawling out faster than any new ones could be caught and thrown in. And, you know, by that common core, I think, you know, what they're referring to is, you know, this idea that Buddhism was sort of this monolithic thing. You know, it was one basic tradition that we could understand. And I think that was maybe the problematic fallacy at the beginning, was thinking, you know, what they're doing in Sri Lanka is exactly the same as what they're doing in Tibet, and we need to kind of, you know, or Japan or Mongolia or wherever you're looking, and we need to figure that out. You know, and I suspect, you know, Buddhist practitioners and others listening could relate, you know, from looking at press coverage about Buddhism, which I think, in the English language, which I think often does that, talks about Buddhism in this way, as if it is one thing, which is unusual. But let's unpack that a little bit more and say a little bit more about it. So the authors, you know, point out the arbitrary nature of this process was best revealed by the lack of agreement about how the ideal Buddhism, that is, could be found. The authors go on to talk a little bit about essentialism, this idea that we can find kind of the essence of all Buddhisms, you know, in one place, and ideal Buddhism, you know, which is kind of like the original kind of skeleton of Buddhism, you know, the basic stuff. And, you know, I mean, I think this is something that scholars have been dealing with, obviously, since 1844. But it's also, you know, aspects of this kind of a conversation that you can identify what is essential, what is true all the time, you know, kind of coming up with a picture of Buddhism that's very systematic, you see aspects of this conversation, I think, played out today in things like, you know, the work of Stephen Batchelor, you know, in Buddhism Without Beliefs, his book. He sort of tries to pare away a lot of metaphysical teachings and, it, you know, quote-unquote cultural aspects of Buddhism and kind of get to what's basic. The hardcore Dharma movement, which there's a lot of writing about on the in the Buddhist blogosphere, I think there are aspects of this and that as well. And the authors, I think, you know, point out what has basically kind of, I think, been noticed in this conversation in the academic world, which is that often when we try to identify an essential core, one of the problems that comes up is it may say more about us than anything essential or ideal. There's the great Greek philosopher Xenophanes, I think, I have to double check this, I think it was him who was the one who said, you know, God doesn't make man in his image, man makes God in his image. And I think that's similarly what we're noticing. And so, you know, one of the critiques, I think, of some of this work across the historical spectrum has been, really, maybe you see nationalistic sentiments coming out here. You know, if someone is, you know, from a particular country or tradition, they tend to kind of, you know, lean on their own as the original or the basic or the most essential. You know, I think a problem the West has had to grapple with is the tendency to want to make Buddhism scientific. So the things that are most empirical and not very religious or metaphysical tend to be the basic stuff, or what we see as the basic stuff. So that would be kind of the critique from the academic world of this essentialism approach to Buddhism, which is to say often it may make things murkier because we end up showing certain allegiances, even unconsciously, in what we do. So one of the reactions, I think, in both the practice world and in the world of Buddhist studies has been to kind of think of things in this inclusivistic way. You know, and that would include kind of, you know, acknowledging that there are a wide variety of traditions and each has their own integrity and, they're you know, different, and maybe we can find a common core, or things like this, and it doesn't have to be one way, but it can be a variety of ways of doing Buddhism. And I think, you know, you see certain Buddhist leaders exemplify this very well. You know, people like His Holiness the Dalai Lama. You know, he was just interviewed in Rolling Stone the week I'm recording this. And, you know, at the end of his interview, when he was talking about his political retirement, you know, he sort of said the work he wants to do now is really around both intra-faith harmony in Buddhism and sort of interfaith religious harmony as well. So I think he's just sort of talking about something that most people have observed about him, which is that he has a very committed inclusivistic perspective, that he really wants to kind of figure out a way of doing things that doesn't sort of say my way or the highway. The authors also point to the, you know, the trouble spots here as well. There's a critical look at the inclusionism kind of position here. And, you know, one of the things that they kind of point out is it often has the kind of consequence of excluding people who aren't part of the inclusionism, who aren't operating in the spirit of inclusionism. So if you have, for example, Buddhists who might be, in a sense, religious exclusivists, whether in a very hard way or kind of a soft way, who say, you know, I do think, you know, my tradition is perhaps more more fundamental, more essential, and I don't really think these other Buddhist traditions are going to get it right. they kind of tend to be left out of the conversation. So is it really truly that kind of pluralistic a position, the inclusionism one, if you're kind of, again, consciously or unconsciously excluding people who don't want to get on board with your vision? Because as inclusionism, you know, as the authors point out, often also comes with the idea of there still being a common core. You know, I think for the Dalai Lama, the common core that he sees with not only Buddhists, but with people of all religious persuasions is compassion. Now, you know, I think the Dalai Lama, frankly, I think he goes to great lengths to really try to include everyone and at least find compassion in every tradition. But, you know, the concern sometimes is, does that exclude what's really maybe fundamental or most basic in other religions? And, you know, someone like Stephen Prothero, who's a religious studies scholar, has done a lot to kind of critique notions like that and say, you know, point out, would an evangelical Christian, for example, say that compassion is the most important thing? You know, no, they might say faith in Jesus Christ is. So is that a problem when we try to say the common core of all religions is compassion? You know, certainly others might say, yes, compassion is very important, but it's not the most basic thing or the thing I necessarily want to make front and center of religious expression or my practice and that sort of thing. You know, there's a book called Buddhist Inclusivism, which is a critique of Buddhist approaches to other religions. And, you know, it's a book I've reviewed and I have a lot of problems with it. But one of the interesting parts of the book is when the author looks at the work of Thich Nhat Hanh, and she sort of points out how in one of his books about Christianity and Buddhism, he says that, you know, this idea of the Holy Spirit has a lot in common with mindfulness. So, you know, perhaps a way of sort of Christian interfaith work would be to emphasize the Holy Spirit and de-emphasize things like doctrine and theology. Now, doctrine and theology are very important in a lot of Christian expression. So, you know, that's kind of problematic to sort of say, oh, let's just forget about this thing that's really important for you maybe, but, you know, isn't so important for us Buddhists, so let's meet here instead. And that comes with its own possibilities and problems. So I think that's what the authors are kind of getting at, these sorts of problems in their critique of the inclusionism position. So they find that maybe one of the best ways to circumvent the problems of the essentialism position and the inclusionism position is to talk about a wide variety of Buddhist traditions as kind of like a family. And the term that they find helpful to do this is Buddhist religions. Now, you know, automatically a critique one might have is, well, do we include anybody who uses the label Buddhist? I mean, what is the... you know, what do you do with people who maybe say, you know, you might have a kind of real trouble with including in kind of a meaningful way because of, you know, error or something in terms of understanding the tradition. You know, there are problems involved in this as well. But the authors sort of say we have four criteria for what would kind of fit in this area. So here are the four criteria verbatim. Here's exactly what they say. One, they are institutionally separate. Two, they cite different sources of inspiration as providing the final word on their doctrines and practices. If they must have some sources in common, at least one of the traditions must state that the common sources provide only a partial expression of the truth, whose complete expression is to be found in sources exclusive to it. Three, they have different views of the ultimate nature of the primary focus of their veneration. In monotheistic religions, they would involve radically different notions of the Godhead. In Buddhist religions, this would involve radically different notions of who or what, in an ultimate sense, the Buddha is. You know, or this is my own interpretation of that, you know, or you know, what the Buddha thought, what the Buddha found, what the Buddha taught, you know, this sort of thing. Four, they have different views on the goal of their practice and the legitimate means used to attain that goal. Again, if they must have some views in common on these matters, at least one of the traditions must maintain that the common elements are only a partial or inferior vision of their religious life, whose complete expression is found in the exclusive elements of its vision. And so then they go on to say this, which I think is, you know, common to a lot of material about understanding the Buddhist world. They say, when these criteria are applied to the living Buddhist traditions of the modern world, it becomes clear that at least three separate Buddhist religions can be delineated. The Theravada tradition, centered on the Pali Canon, the East Asian tradition, centered on the Chinese Canon, and the Tibetan tradition, centered on the Tibetan Canon. You know, they point out that, you know, this could be broken down even further, but then they kind of come back to the idea that, you know, practically for a book like this, you can't keep breaking it down too small. We've got to draw a line at some point. And so, you know, for them, they're going to find it helpful as they proceed to sort of speak of these three traditions as opposed to breaking it down even further. You know, for example, if we're talking about Tibetan Buddhism, you know, you could break it down by the various schools, you know, of Nyingma, Kagyu, Gelugpa, Sakya, and then, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said that we should think of the Bon tradition, which is part of the indigenous religious culture of Tibet, as a fifth school. So, you know, you could sort of go on all day doing this, and the authors realize that at the end of the day they can't do that. They have to make some decisions. You know, the authors sort of tease also some of what's coming up in the book in terms of some things that might show that this way of looking at Buddhism might be very helpful to us in terms of understanding Buddhist religions, broadly speaking. You know, and I think actually they make a good sales pitch for it. And then as the book goes on, you know, yeah, this is actually perhaps a very, very helpful rubric, this term Buddhist religions, for kind of thinking about things if you really want to understand the kind of growth, development, trajectory of Buddhism and Buddhisms through history. And they point out also that there are sort of not only these general advantages of looking at Buddhism with these criteria and with this term, but also educational advantages for looking at it this way. Because again, this is a book really written for college students, largely. I mean, it's a book anybody can buy, but I think it's intended more to be used in classes on Buddhism. And so they point out that it has this helpfulness for religious studies students. And here's what they say. The advantage of viewing these traditions as separate religions are many, but here we will focus on two. One, each tradition is granted its own integrity without invidious comparisons as to whether it is a corrupt, partial, or primitive expression of what it, quote-unquote, should be. Two, students of comparative religion are alerted to the fact that no one tradition speaks for all of Buddhism. Just as it is obvious that there is no point in asking about the, quote-unquote, monotheistic position on a particular moral, political, or spiritual issue, there is no point in asking about, quote-unquote, the Buddhist position. When the religions of the world are compared for whatever purpose, then at the very least, representatives of all three Buddhist religions should have a place at the table. And then they go on to say, I'm quoting a lot, by the way, I'm quoting a lot at length from this introduction just because it's so helpful, but I hope as we move forward, I won't be doing a lot of dry recitation of what's in the book. And then they go on to say this later. Despite their differences, however, it is instructive to view the Buddhist religions as a family, to see how those differences developed and where the family resemblances lie. Thus, this book. There's a tendency in books on Buddhism to engage in what might be called the amoeba fallacy, to view the tradition as an entity with a will to live that moves into a society and adapts itself to its surroundings in order to survive. Here, we've tried to avoid that fallacy and have instead depicted Buddhism as a body of traditions handed down from generation to generation. Although the existence of a tradition may influence the way a particular group of people define their perceived religious needs, they are the active agents in bringing about change in the tradition, just as their embrace or rejection of parts of the tradition brings about changes in them. And so I think that's, again, helping to unpack a little bit why this term and these criteria are helpful, not only for the authors, but I think for us as well. They point out that their presentation in the book is going to try to cover five kind of aspects in a balanced way. And again, I think this will tell us something about how this book is going to unfold and maybe tell you as a listener if you feel like something's missing or, you know, that sort of thing. They want to look at one, ritual, two, devotionalism, three, doctrine, four, meditation practice, and five, institutional history. They see this as sort of corresponding with, the triple gem in the Buddhist world, which is the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And they write, ritual and devotionalism relate to the respect accorded to the Buddha and Bodhisattvas. Doctrine and meditation practice correspond to the Dharma. And institutional history corresponds to the Sangha. They go on to kind of, again, point out that they're covering a lot of material in a small space, so they tend to have an approach that they call the block and bridge approach, which is to have blocks where they talk at great length and in enormous detail on certain really important aspects, and then maybe kind of hop a little quickly over others, but hopefully they've given you the tools so that if it's something you're curious about, it's something you can look at and kind of have a good toolbox to do that. They also maybe point to what they feel like could be a shortcoming, which is in many cases we've given more emphasis to the Dharma than to other aspects of Buddhism, both because of its intrinsic interest and because of its pervasive influence on those other aspects. Rituals and institutions have meaning only when interpreted in light of the doctrine through which that meaning is articulated. In choosing this emphasis, we are honoring an assumption common to all Buddhist religions, that the mind is the primary shaper of the world rather than vice versa. So despite being an academic work, clearly the authors are sort of pointing to how they're trying to not only understand Buddhist religions on their own terms, but maybe really looking at it through a lens that's going to be readily accessible to practitioners. They also point out that the book will be in two parts, essentially. The first six chapters cover the history of Buddhism in India, and the latter six, Buddhism outside of India. And so then going again back to emphasis in the book and how they're covering it, they say this, and I put an asterisk here because I think it's very important what they say. In both parts, we've tried to cover what the most reliable recent historical scholarship has been to unearth what actually happened in the past, as well as how Buddhists in those times and places viewed their own history. So again, they're trying to strike a balance here between what academics have been able to show us about the Buddhist world through history. But they also want to give as much integrity and voice as possible to how Buddhists themselves have understood this. So I think they've set a real a challenge for themselves, obviously, in doing this book. But I wouldn't have chosen it if I didn't think they did a very fine job of that throughout the book. So we're going to get a balance here. And I hope, because they have this sort of dharmic focus in the book, I hope it is as accessible as they want it to be for practitioners listening. And I also appreciate how they have brought in all this recent historical scholarship so that if the world of Buddhist studies and academic knowledge about Buddhism is new to you, I hope this podcast and this book will be really, really helpful to you in terms of filling in some of that knowledge. So we've come to the end of the introduction, and we did the preface. So that's going to be the podcast for this time. I think we probably ran a little long, but it's the first one, so maybe that's appropriate. I really, really want this to be helpful, not only for me as a teacher and someone who's trying to make sure his education is always continuing, but especially for you. So as we move through this, I hope you won't be shy about leaving comments if there's something you want to know more about, if you thought there was something I wasn't particularly clear about, if there's another way of looking that you think might be helpful for me to bring to the proceedings. I do, as I said at the beginning, want to bring in information from outside this book to help unpack the book a little bit. So please, please share, be active in this. I really believe that, at least it's been true for me my whole life, you get as much out of education as you're willing to put in. And I know that sounds like a sort of warmed over bromide, but I really think it's true. So if I'm not hearing from you, there's only so much I'm going to do to be helpful. You know, even if you feel like I'm on the right track, maybe just say that so I have some sense of how I'm doing in terms of relating some of this material to you and helping us all learn by this. So again, thank you, and I hope you'll stay tuned. As I said in the video announcement, I think we could probably keep this up for a long time if I bring, I suppose, this level of thoroughness to the work and not gallop through it. This could be a podcast of a couple of years, so we'll see what happens. But I look forward to this learning with you, and thank you again. May you be happy, may you be well, and may you be peaceful.